Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And your campaign starts today. I'm just mixing it up a little bit, folks. Don't forget your appeal to heaven. Don't forget to utilize every, you know, we need to use every weapon we've got, from fasting and prayer to, you know, getting out and teaching people the Constitution. There are so many things that we need to do. I mean, don't just, you know, there's way too many people, and welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
Is there not, this is my opinion, there are way too many people that just say, I'm leaving it up to the Lord. And they just don't understand in the scriptures that he charges us with the responsibility of taking, you know, control of our lives and these types of things. And so
leaving it up to the Lord means there's people that he's chosen to lead whatever cause it is. So okay. We have to be one of those people.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, I've always learned that, you know, you call upon the Lord to, you know, do all of these things, you know, that you need him to do. But when you get up off your knees, you have to act upon those things and basically, you know, allow him to bless you to do those things. So anyway, there's way too many people that I think are failing to act. There's way too many people that are failing to fulfill their obligation as a citizen within this great nation. We are all supposed to support that Constitution. In other words, if you're just praying and getting, you know, well, I hope everybody supports the Constitution. Well, you're not. You actually have to get out and call people out. The whole point of having an active citizenry is we have to hold people accountable. We have to demand you be held accountable, you scoundrel, or what have you. Anyway.
Yeah, and sometimes he asks us to do things like Jonah and the whale that we don't want to do.
Right. And oh, absolutely.
We got to do it anyway.
Yeah, and that's a story. The Jonah and the whale story is a annual scriptures that the Jews, or actually Israelites, would read. They'd studied that. And it's kind of interesting. I forget what time of year, but that's one of the very few passages that is an annual study reading for that faith, for the Israel or Jews. And so anyway, because they're not the same, right? The Jews are only 1/12 of Israel. So anyhow, okay. So we were in the middle of going into this oath. And what we wanted to do was just kind of let this kind of play out as to what is going to be included, because they've kind of laid out that this is 21 years of age and upwards, resident in each county or parish, including Louisiana, because they have parishes, in the state or states included in his district. So these are the district leaders, which will basically allow these people to vote for delegates by the act aforesaid. Now, what is the act aforesaid? And I think that act aforesaid may be, because I think this is talking about the constitutional conventions for the states, okay? Because at this point, the only federal elections that the state can actually participate in, these territories can participate in, is once they become a state. As a territory, you don't get to choose representation. As a territory, you don't get to choose the president.
Right.
Okay. All right. So, here goes the oath. Go ahead and start.
I, so-and-so, do solemnly swear or affirm in the presence of Almighty God that I am a citizen of the state of blank, that I have resided in said state for however many months next preceding this day, and now reside in the county of blank, or the parish of in said state, as the case may be, that I am 21 years old, that I have not been disfranchised for participation in any rebellion or civil war against the United States, nor for felony committed against the laws of any state or of the United States, that I have never been a member of any state legislature, nor held any executive or judicial office in any state, and afterwards engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, that I have never taken an oath as a member of Congress of the United States, or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, and afterwards engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, that I will faithfully support the Constitution and obey the laws of the United States, and will, to the best of my ability, encourage others so to do, so help me God, which oath or affirmation may be administered by any registering officer.
Now, interestingly enough, I've actually said that I believe it should be a standard every 4 years when we are to vote for our electors as well as our representatives and senators. This only happens every 4 years that we choose an elector. The senator we can choose on, you know, every 2 years. You know, well, actually, it doesn't happen that way. But every 2 years we vote for representation and possibly senators. And so, but every 4 years we're guaranteed to, you know, have an elector that we're supposed to vote for. I believe that we should have to recite that oath of office or that oath of citizenship, this kind of oath, that we will support the Constitution walking into that ballot box. Now, technically, this seemed draconian, but remember, Article 4, Section 3, in the admission of states into the Union, Congress had the power to create whatever necessary rules and regulations of the territory they saw fit in preparing that territory to become a state. So they wanted to make sure that they were not allowing any person who participated in the rebellion. Remember the language. Now, I want to point back to the unknown teeth in the Constitution, the article I wrote, that actually provided you the original language of the 14th Amendment, which included that, which then it was changed to, instead of saying those people that, you know, were in this rebellion, it eliminated that, and instead of punishing the people in the rebellion, it set the standard that any person that has been under oath before or under an oath, you know, at any point in time, and while under oath they've refused or they violated the Constitution or failed to support it, giving aid and comfort to the enemies thereof of the Constitution, are no longer eligible to ever be a public servant, that they are to be banned for life. Now, this is a very powerful addition in the 14th Amendment. It is a huge change from just holding those people as rebellious, you know, at that point in time, just punishing those people. They had the insight to realize that there is, in little ways, rebellions being done against the Constitution. And so, right, wrong, or indifferent, even at that time, they were participating in things that they shouldn't have been doing, even at that time. I want to tell you, folks, that at this point in time, Congress was not perfect. Congress was actually functioning, and the United States government was actually functioning in violation to the Constitution, because they were exercising the Department of Interior, which was created in 1849, and they were possessing properties within states that they had no authority to possess. Huh. So I'm just saying that, to be clear, that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was actually a noose that went around their neck that they never, because they accepted this form of unconstitutional government. And as a matter of fact, what I'm going to do, because I believe, if I remember correctly, if I'm correct, I believe that the Department of Agriculture was created prior to the Civil War. And so I've got a list of all of these departments and when they were founded. And so the Interior was created in 1849. The Department of Justice was created in 1870. So in other words, this Department of Justice was actually created in a way that they didn't have the authority to do. They needed to really create an amendment. However, I believe that today the federal government can possess the Department of Justice for a very specific purpose: accountability. Because we need a separate department in the executive to hold the legislative as well as the judiciary accountable to their oaths. I cannot emphasize this importance of accountability to the oath of office and the oath of citizenship. We have gotten to a point in our society where we have completely marginalized and it means nothing anymore. And true, this is the huge, this goes back to the conversation we had a couple of weeks ago, maybe, when I talked to you about this. We're at that point in time where I'm actually seeing this whole essence of the separation of the wheat from the chaff. And I believe that there's people that are finally recognizing that we as citizens have been living in wickedness because we have marginalized our responsibility as citizens. We're supposed to be able to, and actually we're legally bound to pick up arms to actually fight, to use deadly force against enemies of the Constitution, foreign and domestic. Deadly force. Go out and kill these people that are raising a rebellion against our Constitution. I'm not mincing words here. That is the legal obligation of every citizen of the United States, to support the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. And when you read that oath, and to pick up arms to do so.
Yeah.
Folks, you've got to get your head right when we're looking at what we have this responsibility, because it's just by happen chance. I mean, the divine hand of providence had us actually start this show kind of focusing on this. And now we kind of have meandered into this because we've talked about the marginalization, you know, the people that just pray, but they're not real citizens of this, of the United States. They're citizens, maybe, of his church, maybe, I don't know. But I'm telling you, if you're not a citizen of this United States, which is the government that he created by his inspiration, by his divine hand, all the framers have told us this, then you don't deserve, you shouldn't be here either. We need to do a real awakening of who we are and what we are. Are we a citizen of the kingdom of God? If you're Christian, then you should be just saying yes. And that means that if you're a citizen of the kingdom of God and you recognize his hand in this Constitution and this republic, then you should equally be a citizen discharging your duties as a citizen, period. And the whole point of this duty is to hold people accountable. So this goes back to why I'm on this rant, why I went down this rat hole, is the Department of Justice, I think, was justifiable in some ways as an office back then, because I believe most people, you know, kind of still held this love and this affinity to being a U.S. citizen. We didn't have this huge gap. There were people that were already lending towards communism. You know, as a matter of fact, while I'm talking, do me a favor, because I think you might have a DuckDuckGo or Google or whatever search engine you use. look up the publication of Karl Marx and Engels, The Communist Manifesto. What year was that published? Because I believe that was published in the late 40s, maybe the 60s, somewhere in there, 1840s, 1860s, somewhere in there. And so this concept was just beginning to trickle. How many people in the United States were reading books? Only the educated, only the academics. And so those few people that actually bought a copy of that piece of crap, the Communist Manifesto. Now, I'll have to be honest.
1848,
towards the very end. So it was basically, because we look at 1860, 12 years. It was published in German, and I don't know when it was actually published, if you could look that up. When was the Communist Manifesto first published in English? Because that's when we would have had to read this evil doctrine. So looking in, you know, in the broad spectrum here, I don't believe there were that many people in America that were reading these concepts, because I'd already talked to you about George Fitzhugh. George Fitzhugh was a predecessor in America to the Communist Manifesto, where he talked about slavery. I think it was the early 40s. So in other words, I think this concept, this evil concept of slavery, was being propagated by Satan in many different ways and in different forms, that we needed to subjugate people to have a better society. That was the whole intent behind communism. And that was the whole intent behind slavery thousands and thousands of years ago, to, you know, so that some people could have a better society at the expense of others. And as I said, that there was one of the violations of the very first commandments, where we were all to live by the sweat of our brow, that man must live by the sweat of his brow.
1850.
So it took 2 years. So there may have been 10 years of a few people buying that, but I'm going to tell you the average U.S. citizen didn't. And the average U.S. citizen, having heard and read that type of doctrine, would not have been susceptible, because there's no doubt in my mind that people really didn't see labor as equal. There's a reason why communities were actually paying and basically contributing to having a town doctor. They wanted somebody that had education to help save their lives, because they knew that what that person would bring to their town was much greater than what anybody else in town could do. The concept of the Communist Manifesto was all labor was equal. That was the initial foundation, that all labor was equal, that we should not be elevating any type of labor. And here in America, we realize that wouldn't fly. I mean, when we really think about it, the person that becomes more educated, the person that becomes more literate, actually has an opportunity to help society a lot more. I mean,
absolutely.
I know that I have a level of education that probably supersedes the average American. And my focus being constitutional, you know, is just another kind of layer of how many people have taken on this much information regarding that. So I know that I'm in the company of a 1% class, if not smaller. I mean, folks, let's look at this. 300 million, let's just round it down to 300 million. What's 10% of 300 million? You know, beer math, let's just throw it out there. 30 million, right? You take 10 away from 300, it'd be 30 million. So 1% of 300 million would be 3 million. Now, my question is, are there 3 million people in America that understand the Constitution like we do, or like I do?
Definitely not.
Not even 3 million. So that's why I'm saying that those of us who are taking the time to read these documents that we're reading for you, the ratification debates coming up, you know, and all of these other documents that literally lay the foundation of this government and how that Constitution was defined into a hard, fast definition, something that the federal government and justices did not have the authority to play with, bend, and rewrite. Therefore, those few of us probably are even less than 0.5%, which would be 1 in 1,000,000. 1.5 million, I mean, right? So you keep taking the zeros or divided it in half and so forth. So what, let's call this a club. Let's call this the constitutional, the profound constitutional understanding club. What do you think would actually be included in this? And I'll challenge Larry Arnn that he does not understand the Constitution like those of us who've read the ratification debates. I had a great call I need to share with everybody. The gentleman's name is Eric out of Georgia, and if he hears this, he will know that I'm speaking of him. But here's a man that actually said, because I kept on telling him, you've got to read the ratification debates. Guess what he's been doing? And he's actually, in my last conversation with him this week, he was blown away. Actually, it was last week. He was absolutely blown away at the level of information that you get fed in reading that document in contrast to the Federalist Papers.
Yeah.
So, folks, let's start talking about creating this club of profound knowledge and understanding the Constitution. Because technically, every listener that listens to this show on a regular basis, and it's less than 1,000,000, because when you look at, you know, these show hosts that are bragging over, you know, how many people listen to them, I mean, very few of them are in the 1,000,000 average listeners. Does that make sense? I mean, Rush Limbaugh, yeah. I mean, if you looked at Rush Limbaugh, there was probably a few million. I think Glenn Beck had a few million. I don't know if he still does. But the point is, that's a lot of people listening to you. And here's the question. Why is it that people would rather listen to the entertainers of Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, you know, Buck Sexton and Clay, whatever his name is, and all these other people out there who are entertaining and actually misleading you regarding the Constitution? They're following unconstitutional federal statutes. I mean, they're all making these, you know, like there's this other guy, Jesse, in the afternoon. I mean, I suffer myself listening to these people. And he's talking about we need to arrest and send these people to jail. And I've said the first thing we need to do to every person who's under oath is they need to be actually banned immediately, if then sent into trial. They need to make sure that that person can never step in. You just send them to jail and you don't do that, that person can come out of jail and actually serve as a public servant again. That should be a lifelong punishment when you violated your oath. Citizenship, the same thing. But anyway, I've gone down this rant. And so the whole point back to why I went into this hole is that the Department of Justice was created. It should have been an office. Back in those days, there wasn't enough people. This was the whole point. There wasn't enough communists and enough people to warrant a department. They didn't have criminal justification, nor do they today have criminal justification over all of these crimes that they have assumed. They don't have the jurisdiction and justification to be involved in kidnapping across state lines. That would require an amendment. They only have the crimes committed on the high seas this is their criminal jurisdiction as of today. Crimes committed on the high seas, crimes committed against the laws of nations, the treason, they have that, and they have counterfeiting. Now, they can make regulations regarding the militia, regarding bankruptcy. So technically, because they can make those regulations, they can actually kind of shape the punishments and so forth. But the executions of that have to be done by the states. Because when we look at the execution of the criminal activities, when somebody is violating the law, it requires the militia to do.
Yeah,
that's right there in the Constitution, folks. So understanding these things really helps clarify this. So back then in 1870, the Department of Justice should have not been a department. It should have been an office. Now we're going into break. So with that, we will expound a little bit more on these other departments, but that would be actually taking us away from the content. So actually, I will pull myself out of the rat hole when we come back, and we'll get back into the Reconstruction Act, the last and final Reconstruction Act for the post-slavery Reconstruction. We'll be right back after this. God bless. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Now, I don't want to be the guy labeled as the person that swipes at the entertainers. Unfortunately, there are way too many people in America. As a matter of fact, you know, I think we need to get away from this. I think we need. I look at the news cycle and this commentary as just as bad as pornography. I mean, it's not this moral sin, but this is how Satan is keeping us sidetracked on watching what the heck's going on and buying into the lies and deceit. Because technically, what should be happening is we should be exercising, you know, and demanding compliance to the Constitution. When we look at what Trump is doing, if the United States had a profound understanding of the Constitution, they should actually be yelling, hey, you've got to shut down the Justice Department from making laws. You need to call out the fact that they've never had the authority. There's never been an amendment for them to create law, and it needs to be shut down. Be that guy. Because that's what America needs. We need compliance. We don't need vengeance. I mean, but people like vengeance. Oh boy, I've actually said this, that Trump is doing more, in combating evil than any other president. But let's get it right. Let's not do the evil that they do with a conservative spin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, as I said, I want to get myself out of this rat hole, because that's what happens when I start ranting. And, you know, we were just talking before the show about, you know, trying not to rant, because that's when I have to, you know, kind of compress my peaks and so forth. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. So let's move on. They just went through this oath of office and was making sure that people were not, again, they were using that level of punishment in these states because they could, in the territories, because they could, because the 14th Amendment wasn't being applied to them. So they actually could actually isolate and punish and not allow those people to vote. Okay, so Section 2, let's go ahead.
And be it further enacted that after the completion of the registration hereby provided for in any state, at such time and place and places therein as the commanding general shall appoint and direct, of which at least 30 days public notice shall be given, an election shall be held of delegates to a convention for the purpose of establishing a constitution and civil government for such state loyal to the Union. Said convention in each state, for such state loyal to the Union, said convention in each state, except Virginia, to consist of the same number of the members as the most numerous branch of the state legislature of such state in the year 1860, to be appointed among the several districts, counties, or parishes of such state by the commanding general, giving to each representation the ratio of voters registered as aforesaid, as nearly as may be, the convention in Virginia shall consist of the same number of members as represented in as represented the territory now constituting Virginia in the most numerous branch of the legislature of said state in the year 1860, to be apportioned as aforesaid.
Okay, so they were just laying out how many representatives that they were going to have in creating these states as they kind of move forward. Okay, but again, they have not been. And then when I look at, because I have a little chart here, and folks, you can create this yourself. And I'm not a fan of Wikipedia, but at least Wikipedia puts out the real information on the 14th Amendment as far as rejections and then ratifications. The next state after Tennessee out of the South to ratify the 14th Amendment is North Carolina. Now, when was the 14th Amendment ratified? It was ratified June 15th, 1867. So a year and 1 month later, North Carolina ratified. Louisiana then ratified. So just remember that these states that were joining the Union now, they didn't have to specifically ratify the 14th Amendment. When they came into the Union, they ratified the entire Constitution, including the 14th Amendment. Okay? So right. Louisiana then followed July 9th, 5 days later, with South Carolina July 9th, and then Alabama July 13th, and then Georgia July 21st, and then now we go a year and a few months, about a year and 4 months later, when Virginia joined the Union. They rejoined the Union. That was in October of 1869. Basically more than 2 years after the ratification of the 14th Amendment. And the rest of the states that joined was Mississippi in 1870 and Texas in 1870. And then Delaware ratified. Now, these other states that ratified were in the Union. They just, you know, they didn't need to ratify. This is the interesting thing. Once a constitutional amendment has been ratified, you don't have to convene your convention, and your state legislature doesn't have to spend any money debating it if it has been honestly ratified. It is important, if you ask me, to do the debate and ratification. But to do it in, let me see here, Delaware, to do it 40 years later almost, 35 some odd years later, is stupid, imbecilic, because the intent is to ratify and do the debates so that you can, you know, ferret through this and get that done. And the reason why that's important, because some states, well, it's already passed, we don't have to worry about passing it. Even though you want to pass it, right? You may want that amendment passed, and you choose not to spend the money and time on it. That could really backfire on you, because if you find out, as we have found out, that states like Oregon actually played shenanigans on the 16th Amendment or the 17th Amendment. And this is one of the reasons why you have to really examine which amendments were properly ratified or not. But the numbers are there, and you're going to find that these states, then the 14th Amendment was legitimately ratified. There were all of these little ancillary arguments that weren't relevant. Oh, well, we were under duress. No, you were a territory. If you wanted to come in and relieve yourself of, you know, the debt, that would require you to come in and ratify the Constitution. Now, you got to remember that as these states, if they would have came in, like Tennessee, that would have shifted that three-fourths margin up a tick. In other words, now that you require a little bit more. And so I think that it was just, you know, interesting. It wasn't duress. These states, they could have stayed out of the Union. They didn't have to be territories. They could have actually requested complete independence and paid their debt. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
but not one of them wanted to pay their debt. In other words, they wanted their bread buttered on all six sides. Not just two sides, but everywhere around that crust and all of it, they wanted their bread buttered. And so that's typical. I think when you look at people that are opportunists, or when you look at leaders who act like opportunists, they don't just want their bread buttered on two sides. They want it buttered everywhere.
Yeah.
So anyway, so Delaware, Maryland, California, and then Kentucky, which actually Kentucky was in the Union, but they actually were one of the last states to formally ratify it in 1976. Why? Why were they holdouts like that? And then why embarrass yourself to formally ratify it? Why? It, you know, the argument should stand that, well, it was successfully ratified. You didn't need us to spend the time and money. And leave it at that. With the 17th Amendment, sorry for cutting you off. With the 17th Amendment, there's only one state that actually rejected it, which is not, that has not ratified it, which is Utah. The other six states have taken no position, and they don't need to, because they don't have to, you know, play this dance anyway, because the 17th Amendment was a stupid amendment. As the truth about the 17th Amendment is forthcoming. Anyway, all right, so let's move back into this next section, right? Section 3.
And be it therefore enacted that at said election, the registered voters of each state shall vote for or against a convention to form a constitution. Therefore, under this act, those voting in favor of such a convention shall have written or printed on the ballots by which they vote for delegates, as aforesaid, the words "for a convention." Those voting against such a convention shall have written or printed on such ballots the words "against a convention." The person appointed to superintend said election and to make return of the voters given thereat, as herein provided, shall count and make return of the votes given for and against the convention. And the commanding general to whom the same shall have been returned shall ascertain and declare the total vote in each state for and against a convention. If a majority of the votes given on that question shall be for a convention, then such convention shall be held as hereinafter provided. But if a majority of the said votes shall be against a convention, then no such convention shall be held under this act, provided that such convention shall not be held unless a majority of all such registered voters shall have voted on the question of holding such convention.
Okay, so again, to me, this is a way that they could have, had they failed the convention, they could have started isolating those people who were voting against it, because they had a record of that. Remember that elections weren't secret, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so they could have easily, just as those things were coming in, they could have easily said, okay, this guy was against it, this guy was against it, this guy was against it, you know, and they could have perceived them as enemies of the Union because they didn't want to rejoin the Union. Unfortunately, that's what ends up happening when people have that kind of power. But and in those days, because this was such a hot issue, I would see the same thing over other issues like abortion. You know, that the argument of having a secret ballot, you know, over something like abortion, should we actually allow abortion to be voted for? Well, here's the problem. When you have a democracy, in some cases, you know, because when you have a democracy, you in some cases want to be able to have secrecy, because a democracy is a very vulnerable form of government.
Yeah.
And when you're trying to overrule the oppressors, let's say you have oppressors, you may want to actually start voting for things that actually tie their hands and take away their power. Right? I'm just laying it out here, but the democracy is a form of government that we don't have. The problem is that every state violated the Constitution, probably by the behest of Congress, or just due to the fact that we became nimrods and dimwits in understanding constitutions, that no state really established a supermajority of counties, like a supermajority of states, to require that supermajority to amend their constitution. Because all the elections were being done by the counties. The danger was becoming more and more present that elections were being driven by population centers. This is why the education system in the population centers really started skewing towards the left. You know, being more and more liberal-minded. And let's look at it this way. When we look at academic freedom, true academic freedom, that is perceived by many ultra-conservatives as evil. In other words, when you look at the Dark Ages, when academic freedom didn't exist, it was the church who brought forward this academic freedom to make sure that there could be an open and an honest dialogue regarding anything in the sphere of education and in the sphere of debate. And there were still, even in those days, in the early days, there were still these draconian forces that actually didn't like certain debates. During the time when Dante was writing his material, Dante was, you know, always pushing the envelope, and he actually wrote a book that went out the barrier. And this is when the church actually, he wrote, it was the Demarchia, I believe, was the book that he wrote, where it talked about how, you know, the church would actually gain full control of governing the world. And it, interesting book. But the church really viewed that as really, you know, it crossed the line. And so the book was banned and he was banished. And then finally they forgave him and let him back in. But that was under this beginning. This was the beginning of the era of open academia, having truly open dialogue about anything. Now, as we moved forward and we progressed, it was the church that became the champion of allowing and hearing, because they felt that when you actually allowed the argument of the evil, debauchery, and what have you, so you could actually call it out for what it is, for these evil things, then you were always going to win the dialogue. But when all of a sudden the people that were selling it in these liberal states, because we've gotten to that point where they didn't allow you to actually challenge and call out evil for evil. In other words, we went from the religious people support, the religious institutions supporting open academia, academic freedom. And as we went towards that, it opened the door for the liberals. And as the liberals started moving forward, as they were getting themselves entrenched, they started suppressing a little bit and a little bit and a little bit more of the other side's arguments, so that finally they had a full control of the narrative.
Yeah.
And now today, what do the people, the Christians or the religious people, they don't want academic freedom. They want to actually control the narrative. And this is how we get tossed back and forth by democracy of, well, we want to control the narrative. They've controlled it. Now we need to control it, instead of actually going back to where we need to be with the true academic freedom, so that all of, you know, the good and the evil can be exposed, so that people can be enlightened on the true reasons why we shouldn't be gambling, why we shouldn't be, you know, indulging ourselves in harmful behavior, whatever it is. And we have a society that is rife with indulging themselves. I mean, that's what our society is. It's debauchery, you know, almost at its best, only competing with the debauchery of Rome and so forth. But I think we've succeeded way over that. We've superseded that when it comes to live organ harvesting and some of the technology that we've implemented in this debauchery. So anyway, I went into another rat hole on you, and I apologize.
That's all right.
So we're now on section four, and we have 8 minutes. So yeah, we've got time. Let's hit section four.
Okay. And be it further enacted that the commanding general of each district shall appoint as many boards of registration as may be necessary, consisting of 3 loyal officers or persons, to make and complete the registration, superintend the election, and make return to him of the votes, list of voters, and of the persons elected as delegates by a plurality of the votes cast at said election. And upon receiving said returns, he shall open the same, ascertain the persons elected as delegates according to the returns of the officers who conducted said election, and make proclamation thereof. And if a majority of the voters given on that question shall be for a convention, the commanding general, with 60 days from the date of election, shall notify the delegates to assemble in convention at a time and place to be mentioned in the notification, and said convention, when organized, shall proceed to frame a constitution and civil government according to the provisions of this act and the act to which it is supplementary. And when the same shall have been so framed, said constitution shall be submitted by the convention for ratification to the persons registered under the provisions of this act at an election to be conducted by the officers or persons appointed, or to be appointed by the commanding general, as herein before provided, and to be held after the expiration of 30 days from the date of notice thereof, to be given by said convention, and the returns thereof shall be made to the commanding general of the district.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. The delegates that were being chosen, were they chosen as delegates under a district, or were they chosen under the delegates of a county?
It said county.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, now do you see county in here?
County or parish, it said.
Okay. So, folks, who are, based on even in the Reconstruction, here's your evidence, who are the parties to that state constitution?
The counties.
The counties are the parishes. The people of those counties. In other words, see, counties, how many people that were delegates in the Federal Constitutional Convention, how many of those people were perpetual?
I don't know.
That's not a trick question. What does perpetual mean? Continuing, ever living.
How many people continued to be?
Yes, they were perpetual people. In other words, they were to continue to live forever. I mean, they're still alive today. If they're perpetual, they're still alive.
Oh. Huh. None of them.
None. There you go. How many people in these state counties? Because we could have had, some immortality at some point in time, where maybe some of these people, are still alive today. I don't think so. And the reason in the divine order that the people instituted governments and then functioned by delegates of that government to go create a government, a general government to serve them, then we actually understand that the parties are not the people. It is not we, the people, creating government. We create the initial government at the base level. Technically, we actually create the nucleus of government by when a man and a woman choose to actually wed and have a family. They become the basic institution in that county. And they have extended family and so forth with these relationships. But each household is a part of the molecular structure of the governing body, or I should say the sovereigns, for creating that governing body, right? We the people are sovereigns. And so we create a government, and in delegating very specific powers and authority to that county, that's the first government we create. You may have created a city first. You know, when the territories were opening up, you may have created a little town. And eventually all of the towns and the federal government says, hey, there's so many citizens out there in Oregon. We need to actually start creating some counties. And what they did, because instead of having the people do it, they sent out judges. And the judges would be sitting in these districts or these counties, actually. And so they first had a court for the state, for the entire territory. And then eventually they were to have county judges, and eventually these county government. But see, we just looked at, and this is how we elevated this judiciary form of government, because everything was based on judges, not we the people, and not the people instituting that government. And so the judges were the ones that were bringing in their little books of law and saying, well, we're going to make these things illegal. These are going to be the laws of the land. And under the best pretenses, under the best, you know, intent, everybody was trying to create good government. But we failed to build the government the way we were supposed to. We were supposed to build the government by delegating the power to it that we wanted it to possess. This is how we constrain government. Technically, because we never constrained the county, and technically, because we never formally created that county, the urgency of actually creating your county is job one right now. You need to actually get everybody together to actually start talking about having a constitutional convention for your county. You need a constitution. Do you want them to do all of the crap that they're doing today? Heck no. Heck no. And this is why when we really start seeing what we want and making sure that they can't do all the crap that they are doing, then that leaves, you know, this limited government. And then when you actually start, you know, you get enough counties in your state to actually form constitutions, because there's no county out there that I know of that has a constitution that was properly done, where they've delegated the power and, you know, to do roads and those types of things. There may have been an old ancient county out there that has an old ancient, but if you look at the powers delegated, there's probably no correlation to what's been happening in that county over the past century. So anyway, we need to do this. We absolutely have to take this back. So again, those people who are leaving everything up to God, you actually have to, based on the framework of the design of government that he wants us to have, we actually have to institute that government. Don't say you're not going to be involved in this. This is self-governing that requires everybody to be involved. So hopefully this is helping. Hopefully this is making sense. But this actually helps prove the fact that the counties are the parties to creating your state. In other words, this Reconstruction Act, the Fourth Reconstruction Act, and I think the second Reconstruction Act talked about the conventions as well, I think. Was it the first or the second? I forget. Nevertheless, yeah. These conventions where they talked about for convention and against convention, they labeled it, they qualified it down that the counties would be having delegates to go create that state. So in other words, these acts are actually the enabling acts for all of these states to rejoin the union. And we're just running out of time now, folks. But my point is, this is legal precedence of how and who the parties are to our states. So with that, I think that's a great revelation, because those people who want to understand the importance of the county in our Republican form of government, using these Reconstruction Acts is essential in restoring your county government. That's it. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.